Hi, and welcome back to the podcast. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. This week's guest on the podcast is Tim Slattery. Tim is the CEO of APN Property Group, an active manager specialising in listed and unlisted property. He's got a broad range of experience from law to investment banking and, of course, real estate investment management. He's led over $8 billion worth of property deals in Australia and in Europe, covering everything from retail to office, healthcare, and industrial property. Today, we're going to discuss the property cycle, some of the lessons he took from working in European property during the GFC, and how e-commerce is changing the face of property today. I really enjoyed the chat with Tim, and I'm sure you will too. Regular listeners of the podcast are probably used to me asking you to jump on iTunes and subscribe at this point, but I've got a bit of a different request this week. If you've got any friends who are interested in investing, could I ask that you pick out your favourite episode of the podcast and send it their way? Just like subscribing on iTunes, a bigger audience means more visibility and better guests for you to listen to. Thanks in advance, and I hope you enjoy this week's episode. Tim, hello and welcome to the show. It's great to be chatting with you again.
Yeah, good to be here, Pat. Thanks for having me.
I see from looking at your bio before the show that you've got a background in law. I'm just curious, what attracted you to investing in the first place?
Yeah, I had a bit of an interesting start, I suppose, given what I'm doing now. But I studied science and law at university, which was probably a little bit unusual. But I started out buying and selling companies, doing corporate law, mergers and acquisitions. And my first job in real estate was basically doing that in Europe. So I, it's funny. I'm not sure how much I really learned from my days as a lawyer at first pass. But I do certainly think I've got a big attention to detail, which can be a blessing and a curse. But I think there are some similarities with what I was doing. You know, you have to give legal advice to clients, so you know you got to understand the situation and the facts. Go through the law, apply that whole process to it. You know, think about uncertainties. Different scenarios, alternate hypotheses, as well as what the probabilities are and the consequences, and then ultimately deal with clients. So I think there's a few things that took away from that gave me some things that I definitely benefit from today, and also worked with some great people and worked really hard, so you know, learned a lot. But it was a good start.
So do you feel it's been an assistance to your career as an investor?
Yeah, look, I certainly think it has. I think it definitely, taught me sort of a logical, sort of analytical approach to solving problems, which is kind of what we all do every day. So yeah, I definitely think I learned a lot about it. And it's one of the things, I think, you don't realise how much you're learning until afterwards, and then you look back and go, oh yeah, I remember that's how something turned out. And I have taken a fair bit from those few years I spent practicing law. So yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the lessons from your past. The 10-year anniversary of a lot of the key events during the GFC is kind of passing, or has recently passed. I think many investors are kind of using this time to reflect on the lessons from that period. Could you tell us about your experience working in Europe during that time?
Yeah, sure. So I had 3 years working at Freehills Law Firm in Melbourne, and then I guess as you do when you're 25, I decided I always want to go and work overseas. So I resigned. I didn't have a job, or I didn't really have a fixed destination about where I was headed. But I just gone for a run around the town in Melbourne and ran into a guy I hadn't seen for 20 years who was setting up a joint venture investing in property in Europe. And he said, was I interested? And I said, oh, sure, as you do when you're 25. So I was there from 2006 to 2009, and had a fantastic time. But I think, like a lot of people, our sort of vintage, you grow up, you read about the Depression or the 1987 stock market crash, but nothing's quite the same as sort of having a front row ticket to everything that happened. And I certainly saw things that I never expected to see, or I thought basically couldn't happen. I remember clearly sitting in our office in Marble Arch Tower in London, as waking up reading that Merrill Lynch and Bank of America had you know, just merged overnight because basically Bank of America wasn't able to continue trading, which just unthinkable. So I think you certainly learn a lot. You know, some of the things in the property markets that we saw over there. I remember, you know, UK shopping centre financed by the purchaser with 103.5% of the assets value from the bank in debt. So just extraordinary. So the only way the bank was going to get repaid was the asset value, asset going up in value. So, you know, extraordinary stuff. And I think how few people really saw that coming. So, you know, I think the things I took away is just, you know, how cheap and how useless a lot of opinions and forecasts really are when you look at what's happened over time. And I think how dangerous too much debt can be. So, you know, APN, we certainly weren't alone. We had, our share of issues. And I think the fact that the management company hadn't taken on too much debt was one of the reasons we were able to sort of get through and obviously, build the business back from to where it is today. So,
yeah, it certainly was a crazy time. I was fairly new in the industry myself. So it was just, it blew my mind seeing all these things going on, but I didn't really appreciate the significance of a lot of it until many years later. I'm curious, what do you do differently today that you don't think you'd do if it weren't for your experience from the GFC?
Look, I think I've just got a much greater appreciation for uncertainty and I wouldn't say, I think there was a lot of overconfidence going. I mean, that deal I mentioned before about the way it was financed, I mean, the only sensible outcome was the asset going up in value. So I think, you know, having a much greater degree of understanding or respect for the range of outcomes and the downside risk. And I think the comment about debt, it's really, you know, too much debt, it means you lose your equity, you lose your ability to participate in any rebound or upside if you go too far. So I think there's definitely a couple of things there that I've learned. And yeah, I think you've also got anyone who lived through that period, I think, you know, there's a good dose of a good reality check and a good dose of skepticism about, you know, some of the optimism, and I think that's still a healthy dynamic, although, you know, perhaps it's starting to erode a little bit at the edges with some of the things we're seeing today. But I think debt and I guess, you know, the belief in forecasts and, you know, the smart people and flash suits, all that sort of stuff, I think, you know, that really was shown to be full of issues through what happened.
Well, talking about sectors with high levels of debt, the big elephant in the room, I guess, at the moment for everybody when it comes to property is, of course, residential. Now, I know APN are not residential property specialists, but I'd be curious to get your take on how the residential market may or may not affect the rest of the property market. So I guess what I'm curious about is, should investors in, you know, commercial, retail, industrial property, should they be worried about the risks that are coming out of the residential market?
Yeah, look, it's a very interesting question, because I think everyone's got, you know, they either own a property or they're potentially thinking about buying one or renting one. I own a house in Melbourne, and I think it's a fascinating question, because there's really, you know, two sides to it in terms of the residential market. So, I mean, on the one hand, you've got really strong population growth, low vacancy rates, you know, low interest rates, you know, very low unemployment, and still a whole lot of liquidity sort of floating around the system. You know, on the other hand, you've got record price growth for a number of years. You've got banks withdrawing funding, tightening their lending criteria, more taxes in terms of higher stamp duty, and, you know, reduction in incentives, and then a whole lot of, you know, offshore capital that's gone back home. So I think there's a fair bit of risk. So I think the market's probably already corrected 10-15% in terms of residential. So the way we think about it, it's probably less about the risk coming from the residential market, but it's looking at the fundamentals and those drivers and how those things affect commercial property markets. So there's still a few commonalities. You've got, you know, a lot of capital going into the sector. So, you know, whether that's retail investors in Australia, but also Australian institutional investors as well as offshore institutional investors, you know, putting equity into the commercial property markets. You've got cheap debt, and you know, we've had, you know, reasonable economic growth for for a very long period of time. So I think all those things have meant that, you know, we've seen, you know, very significant increases in prices over the last few years. So that to us would say, you know, now's the time probably for a bit more caution about, you know, really paying attention to the fundamentals about, you know, what, you know, who your tenants are, you know, how well capitalized are they, how long are the leases, and then really what you're paying for a piece of real estate. So yeah, I definitely think there's a few risks starting to emerge, but you know, again, I think if you're looking at, in a, you know, perhaps a crude example, you know, if you're comparing, you know, buying an off the plan 50 square meter apartment in South Bank across the road from here, or in Brisbane, on the one hand, you know, residential investment compared to a, you know, a good quality industrial property, long term lease to a company like, you know, Toll or DHL on a 6 to 7% cash yield. I think they're very different investments, and I think a lot of people often put them together. You know, it's just one big bucket of property, but really commercial's got a lot of reasons to. You know, a lot of differences to residential, and I think understanding those things can sort of help people appreciate you know, commercial property and what it could do for them. So,
yeah, there's certainly not a lot of income coming out of residential property at the moment. With I mean, even gross yields are around what, 2 to 3% on a lot of properties. Once you take out interest expenses and add a few other things onto that, you very quickly get to a negative number there.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think people definitely misunderstand what the real cash yields are. And then, you know, stamp duty is another, you know, it's another big cost. There's a whole lot of costs that I'm not sure people really put into the into their numbers when they're thinking about it. But Australians have a great love affair with residential property, so I'm sure that's probably unlikely to change in the short term. So,
well, let's talk cycles. In your view, where are we actually in the property cycle right now?
Look, I guess I've seen enough forecasts to know how, you know, how hard it is to get that right. So look, it's a very difficult question to answer, and I'm not one to say that we've got a crystal ball, any sort of mortgage on the truth. I just think there's so many factors that are go to, you know, uncertainty and complexity in the market. It's very hard to get right, and definitely getting the, you know, timing right is key. You know, people talk about location being the mantra for investing property. I think you could nearly say that, you know, timing is also critically important. You get the timing wrong, and you can do well, or you can lose a fortune. But so for us, it's hard to see that there isn't some late cycle behaviour, you know, going on. And I guess the sorts of things we are looking at with that comment in mind is, you know, we're seeing speculative development. So, you know, property developers building properties without tenant, without tenant commitments, without leases in place. You're seeing more aggressive financing structures, so more debt being used. And you're also seeing some pretty aggressive leasing assumptions about, you know, how much rental growth there will be. I mean, if you think about buying an office building on a 5% cap rate or yield, and then, you know, you factor in the tenant incentive. So that's the incentive that a developer will pay to a tenant to get them to come into their building. That can be 30 to 40%. So that's 3 to 4 years worth of rent on a 10-year lease. The real cash yield might be, you know, 3%. So, you know, I think there's just some of those things you've got to be assuming that, you know, you're going to be getting more rental growth or more capital upside if you want a reasonable level of return from those sorts of investments. So I think there are some areas that of the market that, you know, do look later cycle, but yeah, I think there's also, you know, there's always still opportunities as well. So
we'll definitely get on to some of the opportunities a little later on in the interview, but before we get to that, I want to just stick with this idea of the late cycle behavior that you're witnessing at the moment. The question, I think, on every investor's mind when you realize that we are late cycle, and the temptation is to want to sell. So is now the time for property investors to be considering selling?
Look, I definitely think now's the time to be disciplined. It's hard to answer, you know, I guess specifically without, you know, particular view on an asset or, you know, a market or a sector. But
well, feel free to talk about individual sectors if you'd like to separate them out.
Yeah, sure. So look, I think it's really important for people to be disciplined. So that, you know, have some view about what you think a really good result would be from a sale. And I think obviously it's a bit different if it's your, you know, if it's your own house. So if it's a commercial property investment you're talking about, I think you do need to be disciplined. But our strategy is a bit different to a lot of other investors. Our whole investment philosophy is based on the objective of buying property to deliver a consistent and reliable income stream. So what that really means is the way we look at investing is really for the longer term, you know, 5-7 years plus. If we're able to generate a consistent income yield of 6-7%, then obviously we pay attention to what we're paying in our entry price. But we think if we can generate 6-7% from a regular income, that's a very good head start on an attractive overall total return. And it's funny how over time that the capital side of things, you know, generally takes care of itself if you've got that, you know, that solid cash income profile. So I know that can seem very simple, and perhaps people would expect, oh, you know, there's got to be a whole lot more sophistication in you know, that sort of investing. But really, the simplicity has served us really well over, you know, 20 plus years. We don't see any reason to change that. And I think there's a lot to be said for simplicity these sorts of environments. So.
There's certainly a lot of very famous and prominent equity investors who would agree with you on that topic.
Well, hopefully we're right.
Well, I think one of the challenges for investors when trying to get an accurate assessment of the supply and demand situation is actually understanding the supply side. There seems to be a lot of conflicting information out there. You know, I see some commentators who have said, you know, there's a massive oversupply coming. And then you see others who are saying, no, the population growth is so large that, you know, that it's eating up all this additional supply. So I'm curious about, how do you guys think about assessing the supply side, and what's your assessment of the situation today?
Yeah, look, I think there's no real shortcuts to it. You've got to take a market by market sort of bottom up approach to looking at exactly what's happening. So, you know, if you're talking about Melbourne and Sydney CBD office markets, you need to, you know, go along and form a view about, you know, what level of rents are sustainable, which buildings are going to be developed, what's happening with employment growth, what's happening to net absorption, so how much space that the office markets are taking up. And that's, you know, got to be a very sort of, you know, detailed, you know, bottom-up type of approach. There are data sources out there, but we, you know, we look at all those sorts of things. And I mean, one thing Australia's not short on is property developers. So you can be pretty confident that as soon as you see cap rates fall, you know, values go up. There's lots of developers that are pretty quick to get their hands on parcels of land and develop. And that's one of the real challenges that, you know, when the pendulum swings too far, like a market like Perth, I think, you know, it's certainly more of a boom bust market. So they do a better job of the highs, and they probably do a worse job of the lows than some other markets around Australia, generally speaking. So I think specifically, I think, yeah, CBD office markets, you know, Sydney's had quite a lot of buildings taken out of the CBD with the new public transport system that's gone in there. So that's provided a bit of an aberration. So you do need to sort of adjust for a few of those things. And I think, you know, while for now we've got, you know, relatively low vacancy levels, you're seeing pretty strong rental growth, inevitably there will be that supply response. I think it's just starting. There's obviously a bit of lead time. You know, it takes 2-4 years to have the buildings built to catch up to meet that demand. But certainly I think you know, in the office markets, with, you know, what's being paid for some sites and the sorts of rental growth assumptions people are making, you know, that's one part of the market that, you know, we'd sort of suggest investors would be well served by being relatively cautious around, just given how much supply may be coming down the pipeline.
Would you be comfortable putting some numbers about the rental growth assumptions that you're seeing out there in the market?
I think, you know, some of the transactions we're seeing would be, you know, assuming Sydney CBD rental growth numbers of, up to 10%, which
per annum,
for the next couple of years.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's probably a combination of the incentives that I mentioned before. So to get a real view on the real cash effective rents, it's pretty easy just to ignore those incentives, but they are a real cost for the long-term cash flow that you're going to generate out of an asset. So there's some pretty bullish assumptions that we think investors are making. Now, they could be right. I'm not suggesting that we've got a crystal ball, but I do think if you look at how much growth there has been and what's coming, that there's a few of those numbers that would start to really cause you to look carefully about what's behind them.
High expectations are always a dangerous thing to be dealing with when you're looking at buying an asset.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it all comes back to the buying. Buying well is critical. I mean, if you don't, you basically always set up for failure. But if you get an attractive entry price, and talk about the financial crisis, the ability to be in cash and have liquidity to take advantage of things when you see those adjustments goes a long way. That's certainly one thing that we've all learned.
So you guys keep cash ready in the case of some kind of correction? Because as you've pointed out, I mean, none of us really ever know when it's coming. Everybody likes to speculate, but is that something you guys do as a rule now?
I think definitely the A-REIT sector has changed significantly from where it was post GFC. I mean, people sort of say it's had a fantastic run. It's sort of gone from 660 odd points to 1400 points, so great run. But they sort of forget that it was at 2600 points before everything melted down. But nowadays, the leverage levels are much lower. They're around 30%. For us, we're net cash in our management company, and certainly our property funds have got substantial acquisition capacity. We're really trying to be patient and disciplined and wait for those opportunities to emerge. So, I definitely think there's some good reasons for that. I think Warren Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway, I think they've got sort of something like $100 billion sitting around in cash. And I think Warren's view is that's just a cost of doing business, and people just need to be comfortable with it. So, I definitely think that's something. And it's hard to know when you're going to have those opportunities to spend it, but
it's a problem I'm sure a lot of people would like to have, how to spend $100 billion.
Yeah, we don't have quite that much. So,
Let's talk risks and opportunities. We'll split it up into two. Let's talk risks first of all. Where are you seeing the biggest risks, as in what sectors or even specific areas geographically? Where are you seeing the biggest risks in the property market today?
I think in the apartment development market, there's certainly some risks that are emerging. You're seeing some big prices being paid for sites. You're seeing banks restricting funding. You're seeing construction costs go up at the same time as obviously the residential base, I think, certainly softening. So I think there's some risks there. I've sort of mentioned that CBD. Office. I think retail, there's a whole lot of, a whole lot going on between industrial and warehousing properties and retail, but certainly still some risks in the lower grade, more challenged retail assets, shopping centres that have got high exposures to specialty tenants. So that's, clothing retailers and the like that are doing it tough at the moment. So I think there's, quite likely, more to play out there. But that said, I don't know that it's all bad news. I think that the big ticket destinational shopping centres that people are going to make a conscious decision to go there for an experience, and also the other end of the spectrum, which is the more convenience based offerings. I think both of those ends of the sector are going to hold up pretty well, and a fair bit of the price. There's already been a fair bit of price adjustment in those retail assets. So yeah, I think there are some opportunities, but across the board, I think there's a reasonable amount of optimism in people's assumptions. So as a general comment overall, I think. It's hard to see that there's going to be, ongoing sort of double-digit plus price increases from here. I just don't think cap rates are going to be able to go too much lower for most of the major asset classes. So, then it's got to be rental growth, and I'm not sure how much you can really expect to get out of that. So,
especially with inflation and GDP growth and income growth all sitting pretty pretty benign, really. I mean, they're not negative or zero, but none of them are exactly powering along.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, there's really not that much wage growth, and there's not a huge amount of productivity gains. So it's hard to see. I mean, the growth will be it could grind sideways for a long period of time. But I think if you're not going to get cap rate compression, where the rental growth is going to come from, I think that's a real question. And again, it depends on markets. I mean, talk about industrial, if you're interested, but I definitely think there's some opportunities in different sectors. But as a general, I completely agree that there's certainly not a lot to get excited about as far as wage growth and that sort of thing.
Well, you touched it on a little bit there. I know you mentioned the convenience retail and the destination retail, but more broadly, where are you seeing good opportunities in today's market?
Yeah, so look, I mean, the easier question to answer would be when do we see opportunities? I definitely think the next sort of 12 to 24 months is likely to present some better buying opportunities than maybe we've got today. And I mean, just a bit, we APM bought about $400 million worth of assets in the 2 years up to 2016. So, we have been active, but I think certainly the last couple of years it's been harder to see value. I think there's, the convenience retail sector. So, you've got good quality retailers, long-term leases. You can buy assets at 6 to 7% cap rates. So I still think that looks like a very attractive risk return profile. Smaller industrial assets, not dissimilar sorts of metrics. So there seems to be a big premium for very large portfolios with very high quality tenant covenants. Sort of seeing industrial assets, trade on sub 5% cap rates with 7 to 8 years left on the leases. That to us doesn't feel like an attractive risk return trade off. There's different markets. I think some of the secondary office markets, markets like Newcastle, business parks in Brisbane and Sydney, where you've still got reasonably modest rents. They're very cost effective. Offices for businesses to base themselves out of. I think that they still look pretty attractive. So they're not the glamorous trophy sorts of assets, but they're kind of workhorses that should still provide a pretty good, strong income profile, which is what we're looking for.
A little bit of a change of direction here. Amazon's coming to Australia. Now, before they can take market share off all of our retailers, they're going to need to build a lot of distribution centres. Can you explain the effect that this is having on industrial property?
Yeah, so I think absolutely. I mean, Amazon is sort of illustrative of what's happening with the growth of online shopping. It's a significant force, and it's a big source of demand for space. I mean, if you think about buying a pair of running shoes, two ways: one through the traditional bricks and mortar retailing, or secondly online. First route, you buy them from a shop. Typically, you've got the shoes coming into Australia from a ship. They're going to a warehouse in a big pallet, and they're getting shipped en masse to the particular retail outlet. Online, they're going to a distribution house, and they're individually picked and packed into that courier box that's arriving at your front door. So if you think about, 100 boxes of shoes and doing that individually, obviously much more space to pick and pack them individually. So what that means is that the amount of space to enable that online shopping experience can be about 3 to 4 times as much industrial space as what you would need with the traditional distribution system. So, that's obviously providing a significant amount of demand for space. And there's also a lot of businesses that want to locate themselves near Amazon, the sort of business synergies that they've got. So, Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, industrial in particular, there are some areas that have got land shortages. So, we're talking about replacement costs or forces that will drive up rents. Certainly, I think those markets are going to benefit from that. We've seen that, and certainly think that can continue. I think that's a significant trend, and certainly where we'd see some opportunity.
Well, that's the main part of the interview, but I've got a few regular questions that I like to ask all of my guests. First of all, could you share something that you've read recently, either a book, an article, or a piece of research that really impressed you?
One thing I came across recently, it's a guy called Howard Marks, who's the founder of an investment manager called Oak Tree. He wrote a paper about risk in October 2015, which I just thought was fantastic, particularly for current environment, and I think people understanding that the returns, but not necessarily appreciating the risks that are taken to generate those returns. So that'd be one thing. I mean, the two other books I've read in the reasonably recent past, The Black Swan by Nassib Taleb, but going a bit about risk and investing and forecasts of these sorts of things. And the other one, I think, from a management perspective, is a book called The Halo Effect by Jim Rosenzweig. That was I thought that was fantastic. Just critical assessment about how much you can really glean from the vast majority of business books that have been written out there. So I thought each of those were really, really interesting. So
excellent. I'll grab some links off you and wire to for the podcast so that the audience can check it out. It's interesting you mentioned Howard Marks. He actually just released a new book, so I'll be holidaying shortly, and that's going to be my holiday reading for next month. So
yeah, I think it's on my list as well, actually. So
we'll have to compare notes once we're both done. If you could go back in time to when you were finishing, say, school or university, and just give yourself one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
Yeah, look, I mean, it'd be pretty tough to narrow it down to just one, but look, I think one thing that I have learned would just be to appreciate how dangerous too much debt can be when you're investing. So both within the companies that you're investing in and also yourself. So
one last question, but before I get into it, I always like to add a little bit of a disclaimer to this question. Don't try this at home. We're not actually suggesting to the audience that you should go out and put all of your money into a single share. It's supposed to be a bit of an exercise in long-term thinking and a little bit of fun. So with that being said, if the market was going to close for the next 5 years, starting from tomorrow, and you could only own shares in one company, what would it be? And if you could just explain why a little bit as well.
Yeah, so look, I should say I'm certainly no stock picker. So with that caveat in mind, I thought with one of the books I mentioned before, I think skin in the game, the idea that you got to look at what people do with their own money. So I own a few shares in Lendlease, and looking through what I own, I think that'd be it. I think it's pretty well run company. It's got a good competitive position for the big mega projects that it undertakes around the world, and it's also got some tailwinds that are going to help it with what's happening with government expenditure and infrastructure and investment around the world. So that'd be it. And I think the other thing I'd say is with the comment about the resi stuff, I own a house in Melbourne. I think for anyone thinking that you're going to see a 30% or 40% fall, you've got to look at people out there. If they thought that was going to happen, then I'm sure they'd be selling their house and trading up. So I think looking at what people kind of do rather than what they say is as good a suggestion as anything. So I hope I'm right.
Sounds good. Well, Tim, thanks very much for coming on the show. It's been great to hear your insights and your thoughts about the property market.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, Patrick.
Well, that's a wrap for this week. As always, I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with Alex Milton, who's the Principal and Co-Portfolio Manager at Novaport Capital. I always really enjoy our small cap episodes, and this one was definitely no exception. It was really interesting chatting with Alex just after the NASDAQ had fallen 4.5% overnight. It's not the kind of opportunity that you get every day. In the meantime, though, please subscribe to us on iTunes, follow us on Twitter at Livewire Markets, and visit our website, livewiremarkets.com. And as always, thanks for listening.